topic of my thing is called it, but it works on my machine, which I'm sure pretty much everybody in this room has heard more times than they would care to admit. My favorite exchange with that with a developer was they said, but it works on my machine, and I said, okay, so you bring your app up on your machine and the functionality works the way that they expected? Well, I can't see why it wouldn't have. And then I killed him. And that was, you know, had to be done. So I'm Glenn Brown. I'm a consultant, solutions architect at Mavenwave Partners, and specializing in release engineering, ALM, DevOps, whatever you want to call it. Before coming to Mavenwave, I was a release engineer at a number of companies you may or may not have heard of, like Orbitz and JP Morgan Chase and a few others. This is me. This is the cutest 1.5-year-old girl in the history of planet Earth. This is my cat. We got him from the shelter. He weighed 20 pounds. He's been on diet cat food for the past 5 years. He now weighs 19 pounds. My wife would basically, if I'd have posted her picture, she would kill me. So there we go. So anyway, we've been talking about build pipelines, and that's been a thing that we've, you know, it's been batted around because obviously this is what we do. We put together a build pipeline, and and this is Jez Humble's wonderful image of, from continuous delivery of what we're looking to do. We're looking to have something that as quick and automated as possible gives, they builds the code and makes sure that it's ready for production. That's, I'm preaching to the choir here. That's basically what we do. So what are our goals? Our goals are visibility. We want people to be able to see what is going on, and consistency. We want to build things exactly the same way every time. Quality assurance. We want to make sure that the code is tested, and if it fails, we give the people the requisite boot to the head. We want fast feedback. We want to be able to know as quickly as possible that the code that's being checked in works. What are some challenges to that? The biggest one is environment disparity. You've got, a developer laptop, you have a few Commodore 64s for QA, and then you have an IBM mainframe for production. This leads to non-standard configurations, different directories. I once had a developer check in code and for a Linux application, and couldn't understand why it wasn't working in QA until I, and just kept on saying it's the build, the problems with the build, until I started paging through the code and saw him outputting a file to /program files, something like that. So there we had a problem. And that's what you run into. And because you have all of these different environments, you end up getting tribal knowledge. You end up getting people saying, oh yeah, that's installed over here on these servers, and this is installed over there on these servers. And the result is inevitably mass hysteria. So what is it that we need to really fix this problem? We need a consistent portable server environment. We want our servers built using code, the whole infrastructure is code mantra, so that you're not manually installing things because different people can do things different ways. We want it lightweight so it can run anywhere from a developer's workstation to production. We want to allow images to derive from other images. Basically, we want to have if you want to have your sysadmins create a base Linux image for you, and your developers, handle whatever is needed to, put together, to support their app. We want to be able to allow them to work separately and yet at the same time stand on each other's shoulders. And so, and we want this shareable through centralized repositories. So that's where Docker comes in. And I'm going to just go through what I was talking about and sort of show you where this is. The servers are built through code. It's built through a Docker file. And as you can see here, this is basically it. It's a fairly easy to read and understand. You know, from Ubuntu, that's just the base Ubuntu image. And then the rest of it is a bunch of installations. There's, as you can see, some port networking and things like that. And then a startup at the end. So anyway, this is where we start getting into sort of the cool thing about it. It's very, very lightweight. It's different from your normal virtual servers environment because it's using a technology called Linux containers that has been around for a long time. Actually, I mean, one of the cool things in this is that about Docker is that nothing is really new. Containers have been around for a few years. Places like Google pretty much only use containers, is my understanding. At least that's what I forgot who it was at one of the Docker events the other day. But what's really nice about it is, as opposed to a virtual machine where you've got a hypervisor server like VMware or something like that, taking up a lot of resources, and then firing up a massive guest OS that does all of the I/O for you and everything, and then your applications, containers make use of the resources of the host OS, and which allows you to run many, many, many more containers sitting on a single host. And it's very lightweight. It comes up literally, as you'll see in a second with when I demo it, it comes up literally in seconds. And you can run, like you could run an entire application server stack on a developer workstation. Provided obviously that it's a Linux workstation and you've got Docker installed. Sorry. So the other important piece of Docker is, in addition to using the Linux container technology, it uses a union file system. And what a union file system allows you to do is what we talked about. Like here, I'm pointing, it's here you have the base image, you have a Debian base image, which was, or you know, in my thing it was Ubuntu, and it just says from Ubuntu, and it grabs the base image from, right now it's just Docker's central thing, but you can keep base images locally using Docker registries that you can spin up on local on hosts and use them internally. And every single one of these could be an independent Docker file, basically inheriting what it got from the previous one that you could publish to your local registry. And once you start downloading them and building them, like once you've downloaded the base Debian image, that's downloaded for good. So you can use that again and again and again without having a lot of overhead in terms of network thing. There's an initial network hit to download the base OS image. There's small ones, like if it's just, you know, if you're doing a Delta image of just installing Emacs, that's going to download from whatever registry you'd have in seconds, because it's really, they store them really just as Delta files, and they combine together as a single Docker image on your workstation or server or whatever. And as I said, it's shareable via centralized repos. So and this is, because it's an open source project, but it's being developed by a company similar to a lot of things out there, and this is sort of where they see their monetizing of this, in that they have a website out there that they, that's a paid website, but you get one repo free, and then you have this sort of a GitHub-y kind of model, where you can store your Docker images either publicly or privately. They're looking down the road at having something that they can put, that they can sell, that they can install on in local servers, but there is an open source Docker registry that you can install that still has a lot of flexibility. The Docker Hub's a little bit more robust, obviously, because they're paying and working on that. So, so at this point, and I'm kind of moving a little fast here, but this is sort of what I see as one of the cool things beyond Docker, and that I think will be interesting down the road, is that this is sort of the beginning and one piece of this idea of the agnostic cloud, which is that you have this ability to literally have layers of abstraction between what your cloud technology is, whether it's an internal cloud or Amazon or whatever, or Google or whatever, or bare metal servers, and you could have Docker on the top, and these the nice thing about these Docker images is that they can essentially run anywhere right now that Linux is installed. So Linux installed, and obviously the Docker's installed. So it's there. They can basically port anywhere. Whereas that's one of the really nice aspects of this. So anyway, I kind of figured I would just sort of show you some aspects of it, show you how I would use it in a continuous integration environment, and then after that I'll take a few questions. So I'll just show you how using it manually at first. So this is using Docker run, which basically goes out and so Docker run basically takes an image that you have either stored in your Docker registry or that, and it basically spins up a mini server for you. And with this one I'm using, and we saw that it came up in literally a second or less. I'll just sort of go through the command line stuff here just to sort of give you an idea of what you do. What I did is, this is essentially a Tomcat server, so I exposed port 8080 locally to port 8095. You don't necessarily have to do that. All you have to do is expose the port, and you can get the IP address, as I'll show you, and just go to 8080 if you want to do that. But as you'll see in a little bit, this is sort of why, as you see when I show you the Maven stuff, this is kind of an important thing, at least in my opinion, on how I would work this out in a CI type environment. But Docker's got a fair amount of utilities now, that basically you can do Docker top. And usually what it asks you for is this is the container ID, which comes out after run, and I'll show you how you can get that from a scripted version. Manually, if you're using Docker, if you're using any of the Docker utilities on a container, you really only need the first three digits in terms of finding information about it. So Docker top 823 is the container ID, and it'll show you the, you know, it's like top, you know. And to find containers you have actively running, I mean, what's nice about the way Docker, what they have it set up is that it runs, it's a lot of very familiar commands. Like, you know, if you want to see what Docker containers you have running, it's Docker PS. Right now I only have one running. And in terms of Docker images, if you want to use them from your registry or from the Docker Hub, getting them from those registries is similar to git commands. Docker, like if you want to get the base Ubuntu image downloaded to your PC, it'd be Docker pull. If you've started a container and you've made some changes to the server, because you can run this interactively, I'll show you that. Using Docker run minus I, and you've got a standard, you know, it's just a standard login. If you want to run this like a daemon in the background and you want to access it, the one thing that you're going to have to do is you will have to set up SSH, and set up an SSH login and things like that. But, you know, the way you would with any other server. So I think I will move on to showing, in terms of that, to showing you, and I apologize if I'm going too fast on this, it's sort of, showing you sort of an implementation of this in a build script so that it can be used. This is a very dumb web app, but it was basically put together for the purpose of testing the Docker stuff. And I'm setting, you know, I basically am spinning up the Docker server. This is Maven to those who haven't used it. I'm just using the ant run plugin to basically spin up the Docker server before I run integration tests, and then I can run Selenium on it and things like that. One thing that you have to keep in mind is that everything in terms of controlling the Docker container sort of hinges on getting that container ID that we saw here with Docker PS earlier. And so, you know, this right here. And from a scripted perspective, they have a way of outputting that to a file so that later, you know, you can read that to get it and pump it into a variable so that you can use that later, which is what I've done here. And so that's basically, I mean, it's similar to doing this with a virtual server environment, and going out and making the VMware calls to spin up a virtual server or spin it down, other than the fact that it takes significantly less time. I ran a build in Jenkins with this, and it's significantly less time and no additional server resources. I ran a build with this in Jenkins today, and the build ran for about 51 seconds. Which, you know, try running a build where you're spinning up and spinning down a virtual server in 51 seconds. So that actually concludes sort of the bulk of the actual presentation. I'm sorry, I feel like I've kind of gone through a whirlwind on this and didn't go very fast, but I wanted to throw it open for questions because there's probably going to be a fair amount of them, I don't know. But so any questions?
To virtual machines. So how is it dealing with disk partitioning, disk access, memory usage, memory access, network interfaces, like all the...
It's essentially making use of the resources provided by the client. It's using right now it's using a technology LXC underneath the covers, although it's abstracted away from that so that it can port over to other server platforms eventually, but it's essentially using containers, control groups, and namespaces to kind of manage existing resources on the host. And you can configure it to a certain extent, but you know, as opposed to a virtual machine, it's not as resource. You still have some potential resource constraints, whereas a virtual machine, you can have sort of
ironclad. Right. I mean, there's two big things, right? One's about kind of security and containerness.
Yeah.
That you can't leak and poke over to your neighbor and pull their data, which is maybe not, we don't care as much to bring up build instances or whatever. Yeah. But so like the file system that a packaged, that a packaged machine sees, it's going to see a file system, looks like a regular Unix file system that's completely contained to itself.
Yeah.
And is there a big hit in like I/O reads and writes when going through that to the physical hardware?
It doesn't really appear to be. It seems to be pretty. I think that's because it's a pretty lightweight layer between the host OS and that. So yeah, it doesn't really seem to be a major hit.
Okay.
Any additional questions? Because I would say the thing that I run into in the past is, you know, obviously you want to be able to get an application up and actually put it through its paces as part of the build process. And one of the things that I have found is, you know, you could do something like virtualization or you could have dedicated dev environments, but it doesn't. There ends up being a tug of war with developers over those, whereas this, you can literally spin them up and down on the fly, which is really, I think, fantastic. But go ahead.
What's the learning curve on the DSL for describing one of these versus if you've got like a bunch of systems guys that are already happy with Chef or something like that? Are they going to feel like this is yet another big thing to learn, or is it pretty straightforward?
I think it's a pretty straightforward, they've got a pretty easy cheap sheet in terms of the file. I mean, there's not a lot of commands to it right now. And a lot of them that are there are quite familiar. So those are pretty nice. That's a pretty nice aspect to it as well. So. And I tend to think that's. I mean, the way I would say it is, I would still be using a Chef or a Puppet, in the sense of, you know, from an environment perspective of saying, because I wouldn't mind a, you know, Glenn's Java app 1.0 container stored in my registry, and as a matter of fact, I think that's one of the nice things about this is that you literally can version control entire host environments, but I wouldn't want a Glenn's Java app 1.0-dev. I'd want some sort of, you know, system like Puppet or Chef sort of maintaining that additional configuration. So,
hey, pretty straightforward questions. One would be, are there some rules that you can point out for knowing how many containers you can have in a box? You know, like I think people have a good sense for VMs, you know, that you can overload for some things but not for others. So what is that the case for containers? And then also, you know, for people like me who have never used containers, what type of application, this is probably an obvious question, but what type of application would be a good fit, if any, so that I would know if they're just not applicable to my type of, you know, my type of apps or what?
Well, I think that I would say that a lot of it depends on, I mean, in terms of the number, it really more hinges on how much resources you're taking up. Like if you're, you know, if you're taking up a gig of memory or a gig of hard disk, that's gonna, you know, at a time to do, you know.
Like, can you overload the memory, for example? Can I say every container gets 5 gigs and I have 5 containers, but I only have 10 gigs on my underlying machine?
I believe that it eventually would die. Like you'd be spinning them up, and I mean, that was actually one thing I was thinking about trying, and I haven't done it yet. Was to basically go into an infinite loop and spin until it dies. That might be an interesting experiment.
Does it die at container initialization, or does it die at the actual usage of the memory? I think is the hardest question.
Yeah. And that is it's an answer I don't have, unfortunately.
So and then it's like optimized for what apps?
Oh, optimized.
Parallelizing apps.
Theoretically, it can run anything, but I would say you'd want. Like it's really kind of geared for what, you know, the type of Heroku or App Engine or Elastic Beanstalk type model of trying to fit small, you know, trying to make small modular apps that you can spin out there. I would say that's where its sweet spot is. But I've asked that question and I've been, you know, and the responses I keep getting are, well, you can run anything on it, but that, you know, it's like, well, yeah, I know, but it'd be interesting to see.
Do you know, just along those lines, do you know something like Red Hat's OpenShift uses containers?
Yes.
It does. Okay.
And Red Hat is actually, they're rolling out a new product that's, a new server product, I think, fairly soon, or a version of Enterprise that's sort of optimized to be running containers. And I know, in addition to... already supporting containers, a lot of the cloud providers are adding them. They support containers in that you can bring up a virtual server and run a container on it. But both Amazon and Google have announced that their sort of app engine, you know, things where it's like we'll give you a Java, a JVM or something like that. They're now talking about spinning up low cost Docker containers that way too.
At the DockerCon last month, just after DockerCon, Google announced that they are throwing support behind Docker. And do you know anything about that, or where they're going to use it, or what kind of support they're giving to Docker?
What they're doing is a couple of things. The first piece that they're working on is similar to what it was, basically a response to what Amazon also announced, which is Amazon announced that they were going to support Docker as an Elastic Beanstalk instance, as opposed to just spinning up a virtual server and adding them. You could run Docker containers on Elastic Beanstalk. Amazon is saying they're putting it into Google App Engine as well. Other things that Google is doing that I know about is they've released a management product. Open sourced it. I'm trying to remember the name of it. That also just came out, but that's one of the things, and they're actively going to be working on that. And but I don't know if the Googlers have any more information on what else they're working on that they can share. So. I think it might be. Yeah, I don't remember off the top of my head.
It supports Docker natively. I assume that's what you meant, but I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, I know that I think pretty much any Linux, although, I mean, pretty much any advanced Linux kernel with it turned on can support it, with containers turned on. The interesting question will be, but my impression is they were also doing something that was like an enterprise server version that was sort of optimized for containers, and I'm not exactly sure what that's.
It's the first RHEL that supports containers.
Well, yeah. RHEL 6 actually supports Docker too, but it's half official, but I think what you might, yeah.
The Red Hat person at least last year said you can use it, but it's not stable yet.
No, it still isn't. But that's Docker's problem, not Red Hat's. But I think what you might be referencing is Project Atomic.
Okay.
Which is basically it's Red Hat Enterprise Linux plus RPM OS tree, which gives you atomic updates. It does crazy LVM snapshotting and grub stuff to give you, you know, you reboot into a new machine, and then if your updates failed, you just roll back using grub and LVM. And then it's designed to basically run containers at a very low level. I think that might be what you're thinking of as Project Atomic. It's
okay.
Nifty stuff.
Yeah, that does sound interesting. And another, I know VMware, I think it was you who told me that VMware said that they were going to be essentially using their management tools to manage containers as opposed to their, like, and that they're theoretically trying to move out of the sort of VM space and into a more management-y type of thing, and that this would be an add-on to that.
But OpenStack is the same way. They're going to orchestrate containers with heat as opposed to like a VM.
Okay, interesting. Well, if there are no more, I will give you back the rest of your time. So thank you for your time, and thank you for your time.